I'm John Fort. You're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Good Wednesday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Today, we got some jitters for tech stocks. They were down big at the start of the trading day. They are making a bit of a comeback here. All S&P sectors, though, are still in the red. Our first guest says to catch the dip while you can. Facebook's under pressure again after that testimony from the whistleblower. We've got Mark Zuckerberg's response to that this hour. And then later, first on CNBC, Box CEO Aaron Levy makes his first TV appearance since winning that proxy fight with Starboard. But let's talk a bit about the nibbling going on in tech specifically. Dominic Chu has some stuff on that. Dom?
Absolutely, Carl. So there is some nibbling right now because we are seeing some of those levels that we've hit in the NASDAQ become attractive for certain folks out there. One way to look at it from a big picture perspective is what's going on with the NASDAQ composite right now. Because as you can see, we are off the session lows, only down by 0.25%. And right here, you can kind of see this move lower. From the highs that we saw on the record, we are now down roughly 6%. So again, making a little bit of a move now. It's also about 3% below its 50-day average price on a rolling basis. Those tended to be levels in the past over this course of this year. Whenever those levels hit below its average prices, we did see some kind of dip buying, so to speak. So that's on the sector level here. Some of the places to watch specifically are some of the most volatile names that we've seen in that tech and communication services type trade, specifically with regard to names in semiconductors. NVIDIA has been one of the more relatively volatile names over the course of the last week or so here. Also, financial technology, PayPal and Square among those names that have seen a lot more of that swing along with the market. Also, Zoom Video, some of those higher growth-oriented names, that's actually down for the day. And then Chinese Internet. Remember a big story just about a month or so ago, a couple months ago. Those names have been very volatile as well. They're still trending lower, however, seeing a bit of a bid for some of those big Chinese tech companies out there. The nibbling is also happening with certain parts of the mega cap technology space and communication services as well. The notable ones here in the middle, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Amazon. You can see their fractional gains. The two that are not participating at this level, Apple and Facebook. We know that Facebook has some headline risk still associated with it. So that mega cap trade seen again, a little bit of dip buying. And then, of course, we'll close it out with the really big picture. We often talk about the 10-year Treasury note yield as that proxy for longer-term interest rates. We just want to show you the 30-year long bond as well. Rates right now, 2.06%. At one point, guys, we hit 2.15%. That's important because it would be the highest level that we've seen since June of this year. So something to keep an eye on. Rates were part of the story with the market volatility in the NASDAQ earlier this year. We'll see, John, whether or not it sticks around for this time as well.
Yeah, Dom, to pull back, widen the aperture a bit, I'm taking a look at what's been happening with certain tech stocks over the past month. I noticed Zoom is down about 14%, Adobe down about 15%. Just some of these pandemic high flyers that I'm looking at, Chegg down about 19%. Do you get the sense that the appetite for risk or maybe the sense that there's more room to run on growth stocks might have moderated a little bit?
Well, the story may have shifted a little bit towards what investors find relative value in, right? So there's this notion that if you do find growth becoming more of an issue down the line, it does hit the mega cap tech stocks, but to a lesser degree than, say, with the smaller and mid cap names or ones that have a lot of more growth expectations built into them. That's why you watch names like the Zooms, maybe the Fastly's of the world, that kind of thing where we thought the pandemic was going to be a huge factor. But let's not also forget, John, that the pandemic itself is a factor as well. If there tends to be a little bit more incremental optimism with regard to the trajectory of those COVID vaccinations and also some of the infection rates turning lower, maybe there's not as much of the attractiveness in some of those pandemic trades as before. Now, in a circumstance like that, if you have all of those playing out, it's maybe not uncommon to see folks turning back to the trade that's worked for the better part of, you can say, a decade and a half now, which has been mega cap technology. So that's the reason why. If you're seeing some of that buy the dip mentality, it's just almost Pavlovian for a lot of investors in this and maybe the previous generation to turn towards that mega cap technology trade. That's the reason why you are seeing at least a little bit of incremental buying right now, John.
Yeah, a little bit of drooling there from Pavlov's dog.
When it comes
to trading, Dom. Great context in the volatility. That's important. Thanks. Now let's turn to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg sharing a note he sent to employees yesterday afternoon outlining his take on both the massive service outage and congressional testimony from whistleblower Francis Haugen. Zuckerberg pushing back against the idea the company prioritizes profits over safety, saying, quote, many of the claims don't make any sense, unquote. The stock hurting recently, now down more than 12% over the past month. Julia, Facebook, not just Zuckerberg, but PR, seeming to try to downplay Haugen's testimony, suggest that she doesn't have the expertise or wasn't in the room where it happened to make some of the statements that she did. But Haugen also getting some support from people who were in those rooms during the times when decisions were made.
Yeah, and it seemed like she got a lot of support from those senators yesterday. But, John, really interesting to see the way Facebook is reacting to this. The fact that Mark Zuckerberg himself has not weighed in on those exposés in the Wall Street Journal that, of course, led up to the unmasking of Frances Haugen, her big interview on Sunday night on 60 Minutes, then her testimony. It took him until last night to respond, and he very much seemed like he was trying to rise above it, not respond to a lot of the specific allegations, but saying just in general, her allegations don't make sense. It's illogical, Carl. And of course, Zuckerberg likes to focus on the logic and reason here. And I think ultimately there are going to be a lot of questions, though, about some of these issues that she raised and whether or not he's trying to sort of gloss over some of these more problematic issues for the company. And I think going forward, he's going to be called to, I'd be shocked if he wasn't called to testify again, Carl, and perhaps really answer some of these pressing questions about whether Facebook needs to take bigger steps to tamp down in the anger that the platform can incite.
Yep. Whether it's a call to appear in front of the committee or this bipartisan group of senators who said they would back an effort to get at least the full set of documents, John, to get a fuller picture of what Haugen was trying to explain. There was, though, some pushback yesterday on the idea that Section 230 would be some kind of remedy, given the fact that 90% of their users are outside of the U.S.
Yeah, that is right. But this idea of adjusting how we look at algorithms and the fact that algorithms sometimes are going to surface certain types of content that are going to provoke a certain type of reaction, that seemed to gain some traction in the 230 discussion. It's certainly relevant to one of the anecdotes in those reports about European politicians saying we're being forced into more extreme positions than we want to take. I think part of what the legacy of this is going to be is that, Carl, the question of algorithms and algorithmic ranking being pushed upon people is going to be front and center.
Yeah, and by the way, B of A does come out and defend Facebook today, Julia, just really quick.
Carl.
They reiterate their buy, target 425, saying they don't see a material impact on engagement.
Yeah, and a lot of analysts pointing out here that Facebook is the biggest game in town between Facebook and Google. Advertisers really feel like those are the best options. We haven't seen anything about advertiser boycotts. The NAACP did ask Zuckerberg for a meeting, so we'll see if that conversation and that call from the NAACP does point to more potential boycotts down the road, Carl.
Yeah. Meantime, talking about the volatility that we've been seeing in tech this week, our first guest says he's been using this pullback to add to some positions in the sector, specifically in semis like Lam Research and AMAT. Joining us this morning, Needham's Chris Retzler. Chris, great to have you with us. Thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So it does kind of feel like maybe chip equipment is some low-hanging fruit here.
Well, the market has been digesting a lot of headlines, a lot of risk, and a lot of unknowns. We're seasonally in probably the toughest time for a lot of these stocks. And, earnings season is just around the corner and it kind of can't get here soon enough. But one thing that we all are observing is that semiconductor shortages are global. And one way to release and relieve that issue is by installing more semi-cap equipment. We think longer term, there's really good secular growth trends in place for semi-cap equipment. Companies like those two you just mentioned, Applied Materials, Lam Research, are two of the best in the industry, highly liquid, larger cap. And we think that those types of names long term would do well, while also there's smaller suppliers into that supply chain, which we also think should begin to benefit after this correction that we've been seeing.
Yeah. Of all of the takes that we've heard in the past couple of weeks, and we'll get a little bit more out of Marvel today, let's hope, is that this would be around for another 12, maybe 18 months. Automakers have sort of echoed that. Do you think that makes sense, that kind of timeline?
I think the supply shortages of semiconductors certainly are around for another year, if not longer. The automotive content that is using semiconductors is multiples from where it was in the traditional car when you look at these EVs. This is just a trend that is coinciding with these shortages. So we're seeing more semiconductors across almost every industry. Automotive is a big one, but we also see it in aerospace, medical, industrial. So semiconductors, we think long term, have a very good trend. The question is it at the leading edge or is it some of the trailing edge? And for some companies, they're even seeing pricing power for the first time in many, many years on those trailing edge semiconductors just because of the shortages. Capacity has to be put in place. And if we can begin to build manufacturing here in the United States, which I personally think is a good geopolitical decision, we're going to see more spend, and that's going to continue over the next few years.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Chris, how do you calculate in the risk around the Chinese market right now more broadly?
So the Chinese have been trying to build out their semiconductor business for many years. They're not at the cutting edge. They're not at where TSMC, Samsung, and Intel is trying to get. They're certainly dealing with their own issues over there. But we think that semiconductor manufacturing within the Chinese industry or economy is still a long-term goal that they would like to build out as they decouple really from Western suppliers. They've seen what can happen, you know, through Huawei and ZTE. Mm-hmm. So they know that they have to manufacture and build out. Chris, they're just not at the cutting edge like Western companies.
Is there danger here, particularly with semi-equipment stocks, that at some point some of these companies might be buying equipment more than they need because it's so hard to get a hold of, and then in the next 18 months or so, there's some digestion that has to happen?
I don't think right now that they're buying more than what they need. I think that there's such a demand to install capacity, as well as the build plans that we're hearing from the primary foundries that they want to place them more in the United States where we haven't had that build out. So we think really what the issue is for semi-cap equipment is they too can't get enough components to fit to finish the products that they have. Demand is not the problem. It's more supply and then also the costs that are going into it, you know, shipping costs, logistics, and that's affecting almost every company out there. And again, I think that's why this earnings season is going to be very interesting for a lot of companies to see which good management teams have been able to manage through this margin compression that we expect to see. The question is, how long does that continue?
Wow. You gotta get chips to make chips is very meta. Chris, appreciate it very much. Good to see you.
You too. Chris Thank Wrestler. You.
And now Box CEO Aaron Levy making his first comment since winning that activist fight. That's next right here on Tech Check. We'll be back in a moment.
We settle 90%+ of the situations, and I would say the overwhelming majority of those work out unbelievably well. So I think that's okay. We also run proxy contests, and sometimes we lose them.
Right.
But that's also okay, because it still ramps up the accountability. It still forces management to make promises to their shareholders that they're going to deliver better. And you have to be able to do both. I would say with Box, the stock is up 60% from when we bought it. So, you know, we're not unhappy. We're happy. But we do think there's more that can be done, and we do think the company's promising more.
That was Starboard's Jeff Smith speaking to our own David Faber in the last hour after the hedge fund's failed proxy contest against the cloud services provider. Box CEO Aaron Levy is with our own Josh Lipton in his first media appearance since that activist fight. Josh?
Julia, thank you. And Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Aaron, as mentioned, this is your first television interview since that proxy battle with Starboard Value ended. You also did introduce some new important features for Box customers just this morning. I did want to start, though, Aaron, really with the big story that's just dominating headlines right now, and that is Facebook. Big, important questions about Facebook, but then also broadly about tech and trust. And I want to get your sense, Aaron, just as about how you're thinking about that issue and how you think it should be addressed.
Yeah, this is certainly a major moment in the technology industry where you now have platforms where the government is deciding that we have to drive greater accountability and possibly regulation for how these platforms operate and the kind of information that people consume and are able to share freely over the web. And, you know, these are issues that I think have been brewing for the past couple of decades, and social media, you know, only multiplied the sort of technical ability for this information to spread. And I think we're going to have to reckon with what is the modern way that we regulate these platforms. I don't necessarily know that I've heard the perfect theory of how that should happen, but it does stand to reason that there will be more regulation in this space. And I think even Facebook would argue that there should be regulation. There's a bit too much that the private sector is having to take responsibility for that they would rather have the government decide how these platforms should work from an information standpoint.
And I want to stick, Aaron, with these issues of trust and security, because this morning, BoxWorks, you all did introduce some new features. One was this security feature designed to combat ransomware attacks. I'm interested, Aaron, why you introduced this feature now. Was it something that Box customers had been demanding from you?
Yeah, so we have long had a massive investment in data protection, security, and data privacy. And so we're taking that even further with our Box Shield product that can now do advanced malware detection. And in this case, even help prevent the spread of ransomware. So if there's any kind of ransomware that can infect a machine, any of that data that might be spreading through people's content, we can help detect and ultimately prevent. There's a lot more innovation to come around ransomware detection and prevention, but we have definitely a major initial announcement today at BoxWorks. When we broaden out the scope of our announcements, we're investing in all new ways to help customers collaborate and drive workflows on their content. We have new partnership updates with Microsoft across Office and Teams. We have a great new partnership with Slack, Zoom, WebEx, and other companies. And then we're doubling down in areas like e-signature and workflow automation. So a lot of innovation, certainly the most innovation that that we've had in any other BoxWorks in our company's history.
Hey, Aaron, good morning. It's John Fort. So we just
heard from
Starboard's Jeff Smith last hour. He's not unhappy. In fact, he said he's happy with the way all of that turned out. Are you happy? And what did you learn from that proxy fight?
Yeah, well, so certainly we appreciate how shareholders ultimately voted. You know, we have a pretty clear path forward for the company to both drive growth and greater profitability levels from where we're at today. And we appreciate that shareholders ultimately validated that strategy, you know, through the shareholder vote. When I look at the proxy contest broadly or the activism, you know, engagement broadly, you know, I think that we really embraced Starboard and their messages early on. A couple of years ago, they came into the business, had really great perspective on driving greater profitability in the company. We ultimately worked with them to restructure our board. We brought in great independent board directors and operators. And so we took a very constructive approach. Now, at some point, we had some slight differences of opinion around what the next chapter should look like, but their approved board members remain on the board, remain very strategic for us. Bethany is now the chair of the board who came on as a part of that settlement. So we're really happy about overall how that relationship, you know, evolved. And we might have some, you know, disagreements here and there with you know, maybe how to drive the greatest amount of shareholder value going forward. But ultimately, we've always tried to take a constructive and collaborative approach with shareholders, and that will continue with Starboard and any other shareholder going forward.
So, Aaron, tell us what this next chapter does look like after this Starboard battle is over. Where are you going to be investing beyond, obviously, this new focus on security?
Yeah, I think if you look at what the world and what enterprises are facing today, there's three big challenges. And actually, we kicked off with security and privacy, but you have distributed work, which is changing all the places that we're going to work from. And then you have every single business transaction going digitally. So when you think about distributed work, digital first experiences, and data security, what's at the center of all of that? It's companies' content. It's the life sciences organization that has to do clinical drug trials and all the research data that goes into that. It's media companies that have to produce new films and television content. It's healthcare providers or banks that have to onboard new clients or patients. So content sits at the center of all of the digital transformation that we're seeing in the enterprise. And so we are building the leading content cloud to power the complete life cycle of content for over 100,000 customers. So you're going to see us double down with additional new products that we expand into. We're going to make sure that we bring those products to all of our customer base through certainly a much more optimized go-to-market motion. Areas like e-signature are just a recent example of this. So we just entered the e-sign space with Box Sign. And we're going to be ensuring that all of our customers have access to e-signature built directly into Box. So you're going to see more innovation like that over time. And today at our customer event, we're going to be revealing a whole bunch of new product and capability areas that will extend the power of our platform.
So, Aaron, you've got the game plan for Box laid out, the strategy there. I know when I speak to some financial analysts on the street who cover Box, the worry for some of them is how competitors could come in and possibly disrupt that game plan. And one competitor they bring up would be Microsoft. And what they'll say is, you know, Nadella's in there with OneDrive. He's integrating it with Teams, obviously very popular. How much of a threat is that? Because some analysts clearly have reservations. They're not as confident about your pathway to strong growth and improving profitability given that rival.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to a couple of skeptical analysts, which is, you know, always good to have within within a shareholder base. I think largely, actually, our analyst base is very bullish on the story and the stock on the upside. So I think when you look at the context of we have 100,000 customers, we've guided up multiple times this year and beat and raised our targets multiple times this year. Customers are voting with their dollars every single day on our platform. And as it relates to Microsoft, we actually have a dramatically enhanced partnership with Microsoft. So just today, we're going to be integrating with Microsoft Office more deeply on the desktop. We're going to be integrating with Teams more deeply in the cloud. And so when customers want to be able to have a best of breed content cloud that can manage their content across any application, whether that's Salesforce, Slack, Zoom, WebEx, ServiceNow, and Microsoft products, our content cloud, we believe, is really going to be the best choice. But again, it will be a competitive and dynamic landscape, but you're going to see that we are driving massive differentiation in the form of data security, protection, workflow automation, data governance, e-signature, and our integrations and openness with every software company out there.
Last question for me, Aaron, is about the IT environment. Our viewers are always interested to get your take on that general software spending environment. What are the trends you're seeing right now? Are small businesses willing to spend more? What are the themes you're spotting?
Yeah, I think so. We just had our CIO conference yesterday, and I think what's amazing right now is the IT organization, the chief information officer, is really at the center of essentially every single enterprise on the planet, whether that's a small, medium business or the world's largest enterprises. And the reason for that is whether you think about distributed work, whether you think about digital first experiences for customers, whether you think about data privacy, compliance, regulation, all of this goes back to the IT organization. So we think IT budgets are going to increase. We think IT strategies are going to become more strategic to the overall sort of growth engine of the company, not just a cost and line item of expense within an organization. And when you have IT at the center of an organization's strategy, whether that's a CPG company, a life sciences company, a bank, that means that you're going to see more innovation. You're going to see more software coming into those organizations. And we're seeing this within our growth rate, where, again, the past two quarters this year, we've been able to exceed our expectations that we put out for Wall Street and been able to guide up both times. So we think it's a very healthy environment. There's a lot of innovation happening right now and a lot of great choice for IT leaders out there.
All right, Aaron Levy, as always, we thank you for your time, sir. John Ford, I'll send it back to you.
All right, Josh Lipton, thank you as well. And now the reporter behind the Facebook files, behind the whistleblower testimony, is going to join us next. Plus, more on today's volatile trading as tech extends losses for the week. Five biggest laggards in the NASDAQ 100 on your screen, Electronic Arts and Cisco among them. As we head to break, Tech Check, back in a moment.
Welcome back to Tech Check. We are resetting here near the bottom of the hour. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Julia Boorstin and John Fort. The churn continues today. Stocks are off the lows of the session by not Not as much, though, as a few moments ago. NASDAQ's down for the seventh time in the last nine sessions as we continue to hover just north of the 4,300 line on the S&P. Let's get a news update with Leslie Picker. Hi, LP.
Hey, Carl, thank you. Here's what's happening at this hour. Ginkgo Bioworks sinking 20%. Citron Research saying the company has no tangible product in the market and negligible revenue from its key synthetic biology technology. The short seller says the company has not meaningfully improved over the last year, even as its valuation shot up 480% to $24 billion. Ginkgo Bioworks went public in a SPAC deal last month. CNBC has reached out to Ginkgo for comment. We will let you know when we hear back. Oil and natural gas prices pulling back after hitting their highest levels in roughly 7 years. Higher inventory levels taking a bite out of the rally, which drove U.S. crude up nearly $80 per barrel. And private sector job growth coming in stronger than expected in September. ADP says 568,000 new positions were added last month. That's the biggest gain since June. Service industries and larger businesses did the most hiring. Back over to you guys.
Thanks, Leslie. And Mark Zuckerberg pushing back after Frances Haugen's congressional testimony. In a Facebook post, the founder saying that many of Haugen's claims, quote, don't make any sense, defending the company's push to make tech products for kids and also to research the impact of Facebook's products. All of this comes after Haugen said that Zuckerberg has the control and decides which metrics the wide-reaching platforms rely on.
Mark has built an organization that is very metrics-driven. It is intended to be flat. There is no unilateral responsibility. The metrics make the decision. Unfortunately, that itself is a decision. And in the end, if he is the CEO and the chairman of Facebook, he is responsible for those decisions.
The buck stops with him.
Joining us now is Wall Street Journal tech reporter Jeff Horowitz. He led the paper's Facebook files reporting that kicked off all of the scrutiny. And also Wired's Stephen Levy, who spent time with Haugen in the field while she worked for Google. Stephen, you also wrote a great book on Facebook, which came out last year. I want to start with you, Stephen, just to get your perspective. Do you think in the wake of all of these revelations, Facebook's going to make any changes?
I think they're going to be forced to make some changes. I think what the terrific reporting the journal did, and and I think we're going to see more as the more documents are before other reporters in certain areas. But really, the question is whether the fundamental change will be made to shift the argument that Zuckerberg made that by and large we're good to. We can't tolerate certain things. Everyone says, one person committing suicide because of bad body image problems, bad mental health on Instagram, that's too many. But the question is, are, 20 million people, young teenage girls suffering mental health issues or having them made worse by Instagram? Where do you have to go to change the product to acknowledge that that's intolerable? And I think that's probably what Facebook leadership is grappling with now. Mark is a rational being. And the question, which is one we've been asking for quite some time, I raise it in my book, is are we going to see that more fundamental shift?
Yeah, interesting question to be raised here. The question is sort of how much the product needs to change to make the changes to the impact. Jeff, are you surprised by the way Zuckerberg responded? Pretty defensive.
No, not really. I mean, to sort of answer the thing that you led off with, yes, the concerns she's raised do make sense. They are very well laid out in the documents that she gathered inside the company. And I think in some respects, it was the wide gap between what the company was saying publicly and what employees themselves could see if they chose to look inside Facebook's own systems that kind of led to Ms. Haugen coming forward.
Stephen, I wonder how you're thinking about...
Yeah, interesting. And then if you...
Go ahead, Julia.
No, please, Carl, go ahead.
Stephen, I'm wondering how you're thinking about how legislators are thinking about what needs to be quote-unquote illegal, because the conversation continues to center around content that either angers users or makes them feel depressed, which clearly is not going to be unique to Facebook, don't you think?
Totally. I mean, you know, what the legislators will do. I think the good thing that came out of this hearing is it was one of the more substantive hearings I've ever experienced, talking about how algorithms work and because you didn't work at Facebook, there weren't all these questions saying, will you commit to Y, X, Y, or Z? And they actually listened to her and she walked them through these documents, which she took from Facebook. So I think that was good. But to me, when you heard Senator Markey, I believe, say, you know, the time is up, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, we're coming for you. I heard that from Dianne Feinstein and other legislators in 2018. It's really difficult to come up with legislation that's not going to trample the First Amendment to limit what Facebook does in this area. It really is going to be a question of public pressure in some respects. In other respects, they mentioned a privacy law, which is up now. We've been waiting for that for years. It's badly, badly needed. And I think that maybe that's one thing they could do for us this session if they can get their act together.
Jeff, it seems to me that Mark Zuckerberg and certainly Frances Haugen are talking past each other, perhaps intentionally, when Zuckerberg is saying that some of the things that were said don't make sense. They seem to make total sense to me. And two of the things that the testimony seemed to really focus in on are, one, the idea that government should have access to anonymized data to at least be able to understand the impact of social networks on society. And then, two, the algorithmic effects on society, on debate, need to be better understood. And perhaps there needs to be legislation to limit the effects that algorithms can have. Does any of that not make sense to you, Jeff?
No, look, I think that's a really good point. Yes, I think one of the things that Ms. Haugen's testimony and I think my conversations with her have really kind of made me think about are that perhaps immediately having a solution to all of this transformational technology isn't the goal. Maybe, like, I thought one of the things that was best about the hearing yesterday, I thought, was that people were actually just listening to someone who knows these systems explain how they work. And so I don't know that, like, legislation needs to be done at the end of the day. I think what you were saying in terms of data access, right now we're in a world where, at the moment, any of hundreds of Facebook engineers can go ahead and run experiments and do good research inside the company. Yet outsiders who are working for the public interest can't, or the government can't. And so I think seeing how data access can be secured that is on a commensurate level as what Facebook employees themselves can access is a really big thing, and perhaps should be arguably more important than anything that, an immediate solution to a platform problem on a societal level. And one thing that Carlos said earlier that I do want to touch on is he asked about whether or not this was going to be the same for all platforms in terms of their effects on users. Per Instagram's own research, and this is in slides that we published, Instagram is aware that its own product has negative effects related to body images, image issues that other platforms do not have. And so these slides are public. This is the company's own operational understanding. I'm not saying that other platforms don't have other problems that they cause that might be different, but in terms of body image and teen girl mental health and sort of negative social comparison, this is something that Instagram is uniquely bad at.
Well, Jeff, it seems like transparency is going to be part of the solution, but likely some sort of regulation will be as well. Jeff and Stephen, thank you both for joining us this morning.
Now, Twitch, the streaming platform owned by Amazon, has been hacked, exposing its source code and the amounts it pays to creators, among other information. Eamon Javers has more on this developing story. Eamon?
John, that's right. Just within the past couple of minutes, Twitch has confirmed that it has been hacked. They say they're working on it. In a post on Twitter, Twitch saying, "We can confirm a breach has taken place. Our teams are working with urgency to understand the extent of this. We'll update the community as soon as additional information is available." Twitch obviously is the online video streaming service so well known for video game streaming and popular among young people, among others who participate in watching other people play video games. What we're looking at on 4 4chan is a post now from the apparent hacker here, who seems to have been posting some red team details, client information, and even information on payouts to the creators, that is, the people who are posting video to the Twitch service. So you can see, apparently, how much each of these creators has been paid. Here's what the hacker said on social media about why they did this. They're saying, the Twitch community is a disgusting, toxic cesspool, so to foster more disruption and competition in the online video gaming space, streaming space, we have completely own them and are releasing source code from almost 6,000 internal repositories. They also say, sort of mocking Jeff Bezos here, Jeff Bezos paid $970 million for this. We're giving it away for free. Hashtag do better Twitch. So an apparent sort of ideological slash political slash anti-Twitch motivation here, although you always have to be careful with what these hackers say about what they're doing and why they're actually doing it. Guys, back over to you.
Eamon, thanks for that breaking news. We'll continue to watch it with your help. That's our Eamon Javers. When we come back, Upstart Holdings up better than 600% this year. Now getting into buy now, pay later. The CEO is going to join us in a moment. Watch Palantir as well, rising after being selected for a U.S. Army contract. Stock is still down over the past week and really has had trouble breaking out of the 20s for most of the year. We're back in two.
Welcome back. We just told you about the Twitch hack. Let's get a gut check on gaming as names like Activision and Take-Two are down double digits. They're some of the worst laggards on the S&P this year. Activision's made headlines for its workplace probes and paid $18 million to the EEOC last Monday, but the key drivers for these stocks are games. Take-Two's just delayed upcoming Grand Theft Auto to after the holiday window. It's leading to a few downgrades. And Activision's bread and butter, Call of Duty and World of Warcraft, are losing hearts from investors and users. A new report from Baird showing that searches for the games have fallen by more than a third. To make matters worse, World of Warcraft has a new competitor from an unprecedented source. It's Amazon, which after several high-profile gaming failures just put out its latest title, New World, and what's become an instant success and the most played game of the year on the gaming platform Steam. Still got to see how this Twitch hack might play into things, but Amazon CEO Andy Jassy says the company is just getting started in gaming.
We have a belief that that could end up being the largest category in entertainment over a long period of time. You just look at what's happening in games and how social they've become.
And a success for Amazon in gaming, Julia. It's been a little bit of time coming.
Yeah, John, seems like Amazon is a success in so many different fields now. Meanwhile, Bitcoin now above 54K, bucking the market downtrend. Stay with us.
If you're wondering how Cramer is playing this week's tech sell-off, you got to sign up for CNBC's new Investing Club. You get daily emails from Jim right to your inbox. Pretty specific thoughts on individual names. He bought some PayPal yesterday. If you want to know what he's thinking of buying today, go to CNBC.com/investing club, or you can take out your phone, scan the QR code on your screen, and it'll take you straight there. A lot more Tech Check is still ahead, so stay with us.
Welcome back. Taking buy now, pay later on the road, Upstart launching a new auto retail product, helping prospective buyers get financing using artificial intelligence. Lending platforms cashing in on the buy now, pay later boom, up more than 1,300% since its IPO last December. Joining us now, Upstart co-founder and CEO Dave Girard. Dave, good to have you. So there's a quote in your release about this from a partner saying that this is helping them both make lending more, the lending process more transparent and sell vehicles at a higher profit. How is that possible? Because as a buyer, if you make the process transparent to me, I'm going to try to get as low a price as possible.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's pretty much nobody happy about the car buying experience today, either consumers or dealers. So there's a lot of room for fixing, if you will. And, you know, the whole notion of what we do at Upstart, AI-based lending, is with more accurate models, you can actually reduce loss rates and improve or reduce the prices that consumers pay for credit, while at the same time reducing loss rates enough to make it sort of work for everybody. So in the auto industry, in the car retailing and in financing business, there's just so much inefficiency that the models that we've built can make it a much better process and a much better product for the consumer. But at the same time, make it also more profitable, more efficient for car dealers.
So what is the AI able to do that the existing systems can't? Because from what you say, it must be not offering credit to people who seem credit worthy but really wouldn't pay, or and offering credit to people who looked like they weren't credit worthy but actually are. Is that what's happening, and how is the AI able to do that?
Yeah, the whole premise of our business is that credit origination is antiquated. The FICO score was invented 30 years ago, and it's a very blunt, inaccurate tool for identifying who's creditworthy. And that really means most of us are paying too much for credit because of all the inefficiencies and the leaks in the system. With an AI-based system where there's a lot more data, a lot more sophisticated math, you can accurately predict who can pay back a loan and who's not likely to. And when you sort of push forward on that model, which we've been doing for years now, you know, in the end, you can have a far better rate, a far better credit outcome for the consumer, all else being equal, even with loss rates being lower than they were. So it's sort of a win-win opportunity. And it's because, you know, AI is never perfect, but the credit score-based model we've all been using for decades is just terribly inaccurate and inefficient.
Hey, Dave, one thing that I've not heard explained well is why there's such an emphasis on financing right now, especially in the buy now, pay later space, given that households in aggregate have unprecedented levels of cash. How does the model take that dynamic into account?
Yeah, the general buy now, pay later space that you hear so much about these days, I think is a little more of a payment play than a lending play, in the sense of it's really going after that kind of Visa, MasterCard oligopoly, if you will, and really looking at a different way for consumers to pay for something. There is, of course, a bit of lending in there. You pay in four payments, et cetera. But generally, you know, smart models understand the environment they're operating in. And that's what our model always attempts to do. What is the unemployment situation out there? What is the consumer debt load situation? What sort of trends are we seeing? And, you know, these are kind of things that a modern day a system can understand, react to, and be responsive to, so that, you know, at the right moment in time, it is giving the right offer to the right person, or conversely, not giving an offer to the person. And that's ultimately, you know, what better math, better data science can do.
All right.
Dave, appreciate that very much. One more thing before we go here at the top of the hour. Morgan Stanley downgrades their view of the IT hardware industry today. They warn of a drop in spending and a rise in inventory levels. As a result, they take CDW and Seagate from overweight to equal weight, and also cut their price target for HPE, adding their U.S. equity strategy team believes, quote, we are in the later innings of a mid-cycle transition. Over the past 4 months, hardware has been the worst performing tech group and has underperformed the S&P by about 11%. John, sometimes it's been about China and tariffs. Right now, in Katie Huberty's view, it's somewhat about a decelerating cycle for CIOs.
True. While that is happening, also got a note, a firm, we were just talking about buy now, pay later. It's up 13.5% today. So lots of action moving in different directions in tech. Asana also up 6%, Julia.
Yeah, and of course, we can't forget the chip shortage and how that's impacting all of these players. And then we'll see what happens with regulation and Facebook, Carl. That's something we've been talking about really a lot for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, as the Dow's trying to once again inch its way back to some milder losses, down 221, S&P back to 4324. As we work our way through the week, we'll get claims tomorrow again, heading to the jobs number Friday.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern.